Welcome to BIT, the Brilliant Investment Thinkers podcast. Where the Inside Network, a community of financial professionals, come together to discuss the things that matter in advice, investing, and life. Covering everything from growing businesses to regulation and investing. Our guests will reflect on a lifetime in financial services, sharing their stories, knowledge, and experience. And now, here's your podcast.
Welcome to the Brilliant Investment Thinking Podcast. You're with Tan Sharp, Managing Editor of the Inside Network. Today we're talking about financial advice practice management with a particular focus on pricing and the way advisors structure payment for their services, which is a topical issue given what I suspect is a radical change in the price point of advice over the last 5 years as a real confluence of factors have shaken up the industry. From a high point of 30,000 advisors in 2018, although privately I suspect this number was artificially inflated for reasons I'll go into later, to a low point of less than 16,000 advisors at the moment in 2023, the industry's ability to supply services has basically halved. We all know the reasons behind it, the Hayne Royal Commission, the regulatory pressure, the bank exits, dealer group consolidation and all of the rest. So there's no point relitigating that and certainly not what I'm here to do on today's podcast. At the same time, of course, there's been a marked increase in the need for advice as the pandemic brought not only heightened market volatility, but a real sense of fiscal uncertainty to the environment. Of course, in the background, we also have over $3 trillion Australian dollars in the retirement savings pool and a swathe of retiring baby boomers who need help to plan their retirement. Now, the upshot of all this is that the supply-demand dynamic for advice has materially affected the price of it, with research indicating the cost of getting advice has gone up around 40% since 2018. Now, some might say that's too much, but advice is expensive to provide and the cost to serve has certainly moved in line with inflation and a host of other factors. So are advisors charging enough? And how are they charging? Is the old funds under management percentage fee model on the way out in favour of specific fee for service charges, or are they the same thing with different wrapping? Is the whole conversation redundant? To help answer these questions, I have an old friend of mine, someone who specialises in just this topic. Good morning to you, Rob Jones from Peloton Partners.
Good morning, Tan. Good morning to your listeners.
Thank you. Rob, maybe you could set the table and just kick off by telling us about your personal history and what Peloton Partners does.
Certainly, Tan, and forgive that raspy voice. As I mentioned to you a little bit earlier, just a little bit of hangover laryngitis. Look, from a personal point of view, I've been in this wonderful industry now for 23 years. It's been an absolute honour. Prior to that, I was a Victoria Police serving member, ex-detective, and did all sorts of things, but studied business at uni prior to that, enjoyed 10 years in the force and now 23 years in this wonderful industry. I went into a financial planning practice, a small one. We grew that. We sold that into SFG, which was then swallowed up IOOF, now Insignia. And it was during that time that I suppose I honed the Peloton Partners offering after coming up against and reviewing many financial planning practices and always asking myself why, when I was about to buy them or put an offer in, why aren't they sort of pulling out the value that's clearly residing in their own practice? Do they know how to do that? And why would they hand it over to someone like me to tease out? So having done that for a while, I thought I'd like to work on the side of these planning practices. And so I left in 2012 and started Peloton Partners with Michael Harrison, who was also in SFG at the time and sold his firm into SFG. So having used and taken those learnings, we adapted them to Peloton. And really simply, Tan, all Peloton does is prices the value, and I need to stress that, the value and services of financial planning firms to their clients. That's our sole focus, that's our sole energy, and that's where we hedge all of our results to.
Very good. So both ex-financial planners sitting at the table here today, but certainly only one of us was a policeman.
Yeah, that's me.
Very good. So what are you seeing out there at the moment? So mostly, obviously, you come in as a consultant to work with advice firms on their pricing. And what are the sort of major themes when you look out at the advice world at the moment with your clients?
In your summaries, we're spot on with the increase in expenses. Our own research is that the cost of advice since 2019, I know you pull back to 2018, so you're spot on, but since 2019, there's been an average increase of 27 to 30%. Now, that fluctuates from some firms to being quite significant, to others a little bit less than that, but the average is around 30%. It's quite extraordinary. One thing is to assure you of, and your listeners, is that financial planning is alive and well in this country. The value to clients and the importance of advice to their lives is second to none, and it remains so, and it's never really changed. So the quality out there, the quality of advice, the quality of care that the average advisor in this country is delivering to clients is quite extraordinary. And what we're finding is that most advisors actually go the whole yard. They probably care a little bit too much in some respects that they sometimes forget themselves. And I suppose if you were to ask me what is there a recurring theme, it's just that, that the way pricing has evolved in this country, it's to a point where we're still systematically undercharging what we do, and therefore the return to the owners, who often run small practices, risky practices, it's risky being in business, the return isn't where it should be. And the average practice, financial planning practice in this country, whether it's small or large, is returning around 27% per annum. Now, what's interesting is you uncouple that 27%, you take out new business and what it's contributing, and most firms have had a pretty good run this last couple of years of new business, and the underlying profit for where they spend most of their time, where they have most of their expenses pointed at, and where they bear most of their risk, is really only delivering between 18 to 20% on average.
Mm.
Now, that's a really telling number, and it's a number that we focus on a lot. That should be, that profit margin should be around 30%. New business is never guaranteed. It's never guaranteed at a certain level, and with the recent changes proposed under the QA model, some advisors aren't going to feel too happy charging large upfront fees for what might be a 2 to 3 page summary of advice, let alone this big, thick document. So our mission and what we're finding is that the firms out there are still delivering a brilliant service with many more hurdles to jump, but the pricing and the actual return over a long period of time hasn't really changed.
Yeah, sure. It's interesting, a couple of things there. The first one, that you picked up, that advisors probably care too much, and I guess that's it's inherent in the role. The role is to care for clients financially and personally, and it often, I think, sometimes an advisor can conflate that with actually giving a cheaper deal on the advice and discounting that as part of that care package. Is that something you see, that advisors actually kind of combine those two together and don't take care of themselves?
100%. Just taking that a little bit further, we've had examples, and advisors have been very open and transparent in this too. They haven't sort of held back. We've had examples where they might have been in a review meeting. I call them progress meetings in our world.
Sure.
You're always progressing a client. You're never regressing them, so they're progress meetings, where the client has put it on the advisor, for want of a better word, and actually said, hey, listen, I'd like a review of my fees. And then and there, in the meeting, often owners have actually gone and said, well, listen, I might be able to clip that a little bit and take a little bit off. And I find that pretty offensive, to be perfectly honest, knowing just how much they sacrifice sometimes to provide that offer and the effort they go to doing that. I find that incomprehensible at one area, and I'm a little bit negligent at the other, if I can be so cruel, because I believe in it so much.
Yeah, I guess it doesn't, it really inhibits the advisor's ability to give top quality advice if
yes.
They're not actually earning as much. And you also mentioned the quality of advice review and how that may further impact advisors, I guess, emotional ability to charge more, because they won't have these large statements of advice, which in some sense, I guess, validates the advice that they're giving and the charges that they're charging. Do you think that's going to be an issue moving forward, that it's going to be harder for advisors to feel more valid?
It shouldn't be. Mm-hmm. It shouldn't be. But in the main, and having conversations with advisors around the country, some of them have asked me the question, you know, Rob, what's it going to do to our upfront fees? You know, as bizarre as it sounds, we actually feel comfortable putting a $5,000 to $10,000 fee in front of a client with a 400-page document that really doesn't say much at the end of the day. But there's a degree of security in that. And so I'm a little bit concerned that there might be this undervalue or underplay, and we're going to make sure that that doesn't exist. Mm. If it exists in the mind, it shouldn't exist practically. But I can understand where they might go with that and might turn around and say, well, I'm only giving you a 2 to 3 pager. Yet we know that most advisors, many advisors in this country, and do such an extraordinary job, they will research just as much as they do. They'll put so much effort in, because they always do. I want to make sure, as a personal mission, that they get paid for that, and there's a way to do it as well.
Yeah, it goes without saying that all that work that goes into the statement of advice is still there. It's still under the hood.
It's there, it's under the hood, it's backed up by the notes that they'll keep and the strategies that they've considered and the time it takes to develop the plan. For all of that's going to be there.
Absolutely. Let's take a step back for a second and unpack the reasons behind the broad increase in the cost to serve. I mentioned inflationary impacts. That's a broad factor. But also regulation. What are some of the specific regulatory changes that have impacted the cost to serve?
Even though it's been abolished, thankfully, FDS was a problem for advisors.
Yes.
in complying with the fee disclosure statement regime and just crossing off the dots. So legislation has played a part, and also the professionalism of the industry has lifted the barriers of entry. You're getting advisors these days that have to be qualified and walking out and commanding $100,000 base salaries. Now, Tan, only a few years ago, that was $70,000, sometimes less for an associate advisor. Qualified advisors, and they need to be qualified now, walking in the door with 100. So there's been a real material change, not just in general inflation, but obviously wage inflation has been a big part of this, as well as regulation, as well as this notion that, and look, if you get me onto tech, we need another podcast for that. I'll be honest, I've seen almost every single tech stack and tech. I've had them come and present to me to show me how good their tech is. I don't think I've ever seen it work in practice to the extent that the owner rightfully expected it to work, and therefore they're still piling on people. People are expensive. And that's changed. That profile and those numbers have changed over the course of time. You know, you used to run 200 clients per advisor. Now, we used to, when I started this business 12 years ago, have that as one of the metrics. It was a standard benchmark metric almost that there were 200 active clients per advisor. We're about to revise that. Well, we've already revised it down to 140. We're about to take it further now through more firms coming through our model. That'll be about 120, 125.
Yeah, anecdotally, that seems about right to me at the moment. You know,
that's exactly where it's fallen to. Yeah. And yet there is still the intensity of the service proposition, but there has not been a reduction in staff in order to service that, despite the fact that we've got all this tech around and tech's meant to make it more serviceable, more scalable, and more cheaper to run. That's not occurring as quickly as everyone thinks.
Yeah, we went through that in a podcast with Pete Warne, actually, from Frenura Group, who I'm sure you're familiar with.
Yep.
And his argument was that the tech is out there. It's just a matter of not only having the stones to use it and to adopt it, but also to have help planning in it. And I think that's where a lot of advice practices fall on tech, is that they understandably try to do it themselves, and not many have a chief technology officer these days, of course.
No.
And they end up with a tech pile, as Pete would say, instead of a
tech
viable
pile,
tech stack.
100%.
Yeah.
And look, one of the other things we've noticed is that firms at a certain size, and that size seems to be around the 15 staff, maybe five advisors, sort of, you know, 600-odd clients, they tend to want to employ managers. And the employment of managers is expensive as well. The owner sort of pulls back a little bit and doesn't necessarily have the skills, and employees management are expensive. So there's a real, very clear trend in the size of firms, their time in business, and the need to employ specialist support. And often that's expensive as well. And all of this contributes to the rising cost.
Yeah, absolutely. Once you start having all your advisors and then all your sort of power planners and service staff, then you add compliance managers and technology managers on top of that, and you put some more layers of executive salaries that aren't actually bringing in revenue, things get a little bit tougher around the edges.
Indeed.
Very good. Okay, so advisors need to charge more to counteract all these costs we just spoke about. But if we address the elephant in the room, are advisors actually charging more simply because they can, because supply and demand forces mean they're able to command higher fees?
There may be an element of that. In our world, and tracking clients every week that we do and the movement in fees, it's not because they're charging more. It's because they've got a much, much better understanding of what they currently charge and where it's inefficient. It's not a matter of trying to get away with something because of supply-demand curve. You know, if most clients heard that in the room and we had them sitting here with us, they'd be a bit upset by any of that language. But when you get the cost understood properly and it's variable between clients, and then you apply a simple profit margin on top that's fair and reasonable, we find that's driving it more than anything. And the success of advisors who present that to their clients in a really open, transparent and factual way is dealing with the undercharging issue by and large in a massive way. It is not just that they can get away with it at all.
Yeah. No,
clients still have choice.
Yep. Yep. I was playing devil's advocate there,
clear.
It's good. Now, you mentioned that there are obviously that practices are getting it wrong, and it's a topic we've talked about a little bit over the years. What are they doing that's right and what are they doing that's wrong? What should advisors be doing when it comes to their pricing structures?
I've mentioned this to you before, Tom, but one of the privileges of doing what we do is listening to the stories that advisors tell us of their clients when we go to price them. Pricing isn't just about some amateurish attempt to work out a few hours and then add those hours up. It's a story of value. And when you listen to the stories we've heard, and we've heard nearly 13,000 of them, of just the quality, the depth of knowledge and understanding and care that advisors have, that's what they do well. The way they navigate clients through all sorts of ups and downs and ins and outs, the way they involve themselves in their lives and provide incredible solutions to support them and navigate them through what is really tricky territory, let's face it, personal finance and security, money security. And it's not just about money, as we all know, but that's what they do so superbly well. Where it gets mucked up and where it fails is that in the giving and the doing of that, they lose sight of their own, sometimes their own trajectory. And then they start making decisions based on poor information and poor inputs, and that plays out in their profit and loss statement all the time. And so many times when we do a look back of 5 years, 10 years, often more, we see the rhythms of poor decision making based on there not being a safety net, a profit margin. I need to keep rehashing that, a profit margin safety net. If they had that, they can make better decisions. They can invest in their business knowing what the return needs to be and should be and how it needs to ebb and flow. Their return is just as important as the value a client receives, as far as I'm concerned.
That'd be interesting, because you'd have a really a unique view of, as you say, those patterns of decision making at different price, at different practices across the country. And I imagine you would see some themes in those kind of rhythms when it comes to decision making. Are there any specific cohorts that are pricing, say, less efficiently than others? Is it sort of, I don't know if it would be demographically or geographically for that matter, or any type of business that seems to get it wrong, you know, whether they're charging too much or not enough or without enough flexibility? Is there anything that strikes you that sticks out?
Nothing immediately obvious, Tom, because unfortunately, some of those numbers I quoted before around average profitability and net profit, et cetera, they exist across the large, the big, they exist across the small. It's like you said, it's the points of inflection when the firm needs to stop and really understand its go-forward strategy that they make these decisions to invest. And where do they run to most? They run to always looking after the client first. Now, I sit here and I'm a massive advocate for advisors and I love what they do, but I'm interested in making sure that there is a right and fair outcome for a client and a right and fair return for a business. It's a really simple statement, but it's profound and it's one we stick to. But where I see them making these decisions, they always favour the client. In other words, taking money out of their own pocket, constantly feeding it back to clients, either through a tech stack update and some new thing that they want to put into the business, which is quite costly. Maybe it's a change of licensee. Licensee fees have gone up. That's another one of those increasing factors.
Yeah. As has PI.
As has PI. And then the other one is people. One of the easiest so-called fixes for a business, and I've actually listened to an owner who said to me after 35 years of being in business, and it wasn't an easy conversation, he said, the very first opening he said to me was, I know a bit about what you guys do. I'm actually embarrassed to have this conversation with you. I took the eyes off the ball a bit. Brought in a general manager. The general manager was, after a while, was feeling reflected pressure from the advice side of the business. Straight away, the response to that reflected pressure was, I need another associate. I need another CSO. I need this. I need that. And what ended up happening is that this poor owner, who was 2 years out of wanting to retire, has had to stay in business for another 5 to 7 years to fix up some of these issues because the profit is terrible, the state of the balance sheet, the P&L is awful, and it doesn't reflect the true value of that firm, and he just let it go. And it's a sad state of affairs, but that's where they run to. It's running to put more cost into the business, and there's got to be something that protects their interests as well. Because you need a healthy business. You need to be able to reinvest.
Especially if you're looking to retire and you're looking to sell off the business.
Of course. Yeah. Absolutely. And to invest in great people and new people and systems and process. You need that capacity.
Yeah. So talk to me about funds under management, the percentage pricing, which is, I guess, endemic in advice and I guess the legacy pricing model for so many years versus flat fee for service. Does it really matter? I mean, I've always thought to myself during this whole debate that you could really always just dress up one as the other. You can take a percentage and then call it a flat fee and then every year renegotiate that flat fee. Is it a redundant conversation? And is there something else that we should be focusing on?
personally been involved in pricing for so many years, I get a bit bored with it. I get bored with, Rob, we have a percentage base fee. You're going to tell me to do a fixed fee. I'm not going to tell you to do a fixed fee at all. Whether you've got a fixed fee, I'm not going to tell you it's wrong necessarily, but any pricing framework that is fundamentally single factor based is a problem. Advice is complex. The support structures to enable advice are complex. People are complex. So I favour absolutely, I don't care what we stand in front of, I favour a multi-factor approach to deal with the value a business provides, the variability in the clients that they look after, which is substantial. Having done this for so many years and had 13,000 clients go through our process, I can honestly tell you, Tan, one, I've never seen two businesses that are identical and provide an identical level of service, provide an identical elasticity of their service offer, have the same type of clients identically. So why should pricing be identical? They're all different. We favour a multi-factor approach to deal with the multi-factors that advisors face with, and it does not matter if they have a really sophisticated fixed fee, and some people seem to think it's better than a percentage fee for some reason. If it doesn't work because it's largely just dressed up as a percentage fee and we call it a platinum client because the client's got pays over $10,000 because they've got over $1 million in funds under management, it's still a single factor model dressed up. I just feel as an industry, because things are so complex in dealing with people, we should have a more complex but not overly complex fee structure to deal with that so it can actually interpret the differences in people and most importantly can also deal with the changes in business costs.
Yeah, you mentioned the word complexity there quite a bit, and I think a lot of advice groups have moved towards that model where it is multi-factor and the broad overarching factor is complexity, you know, whether it's the funds under management, the family unit itself, the degree to which you need to bring in accountants and lawyers and things like that. It's I think that's a truly holistic model.
That's complex on structure sometimes, but there's also complex on people.
Yes.
Where it kicks in, and I'm sure the listeners, if they're financial advisors out there, they know that they've got a client that they, perhaps their financial acumen and understanding is not where it needs to be and they need to really work hard on the education side. They've got other clients who are really financially savvy, but they have an ovation of time. They want to buy time back for their family. So their relationship with their advisor is more time-based. You're doing the things I really don't want to do because I want to enjoy other aspects of my life. And there are so many other variables that sit around the client value bit, and we try and get that right. That's where it is also complex.
Yeah. Okay, well, final words for practice managers, Robs. What is the one broad tip that you would give advisors who are listening to this podcast and may not be in a position to procure your services just now, but are really starting to think about the way that they structure their pricing?
Yeah, sure. Look after yourself as equally as you look after your client. Know your numbers intimately. Structure something that you know is fair for a client, but it has to be stapled to fairness for you. I can tell you, Tan, the problems that we walk into is when that balance is out of kilter either way. Either the firm looks after themselves and are actually charging way overs. It's rare, but it has happened. Most of the time it's way under. So whatever you're thinking about, make sure you do the math and understand it's got to work for you too. Don't just make it work for the client. Don't just do an arbitrary, I'll increase my fees by $1,000 or whatever, which I've heard so many times, and I think it's crazy because it can actually really bugger things up and it doesn't really work well. But make sure you're in the equation and make sure it's clear and make sure you know your numbers. Really, really well.
Good advice. Well, that concludes today's podcast. I hope you found it as interesting as I did, hearing from a real subject matter expert on pricing in advice. Thank you, Rob.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks, listeners.